How is it possible to worship God when there is no place, no sanctuary to worship Him? We are continuing our series on His wondrous cross, the story of redemption, and our topic today is Jesus and the sanctuary. My conversation partners are again Paul Dibdahl and Larry Baburka, colleagues from the School of Theology. Welcome.
Thank you, Alden. Nice to be here.
Now, I'd like to start out with a question. How in the world do you worship God where there is no sanctuary?
A long pause.
Yeah. I'm thinking of several stories, and if there is no specific place, because there were times in Israel's history when Jerusalem was destroyed and that place was gone, there are even temporary sorts of accommodations, but always there was this sort of in the mind's eye a place, and Daniel will pray toward Jerusalem. I mean, in his mind, he sees the place. That mm-hmm. place then is in his heart. You can't take the place out of the man in some respects. And so even mm-hmm. though he's in a different place, he still orients his whole worship, his whole focus of God, and he aims himself in that direction.
But is that... Well, I'm thinking of the other aspect that we don't have anymore. We don't have the blood sacrifices. If you go back to the Old Testament up to the end of the Jerusalem temple, you had blood sacrifices and you had a place. We have no more blood sacrifices. We have only a heavenly sanctuary. How does one keep the meaning of those symbols alive, or are they that crucial if you can't actually reenact them in the flesh?
I think something is lost when you lose that place. I think of other world religions where there are places which are just recognized as sort of the center, and we don't have that in Christianity, I don't think. And I think something is lost when we lose a very literal, concrete, holy place that's just recognized as that.
We do try to multiply that, though. You think of all the churches and the presence of the cross in both the structure as well as the liturgy. It's almost like bringing that place or that event forward in some sort of concrete way.
I think it's an attempt to do that, mm-hmm. but I think maybe with the... so many of them that actually we lose some of the sense of the holy because there are so many. I think we've lost something because we lack that recognized holy place that is here. And we still haven't answered your question, Alden. But.
Well, I think the American system, you know, where everything is run and jump and dash and splash and all those kinds of things, I see a real nostalgia when Americans go to Europe and they go into these massive cathedrals. Marvelous, they said. But the ironic thing is that the Europeans who live among these massive cathedrals don't use them for places of worship, by and large. They don't worship at all.
Yeah.
So what's happened? They have these beautiful cathedrals that were acts of love. Now, Protestantism has become very rational. You know, we have the center no longer the sacrifice, the altar, but the Word of God. It's a very rational kind of thing. But those who are sensory oriented don't have that same kind of meaning. Now, Larry, I want to extract just a bit more out of you. You work with counseling and probably see the difference for those who have more concrete needs, who need place and specific concrete symbols, is over those who can kind of escape into the mind and live in the more abstract realm. How do we meet both of those needs with one worshiping community today?
Well, I think that's a real challenge. I mean, it is the case that the different temperaments find different worship experiences more meaningful. Mm-hmm. And some find the sort of constancy of a planned ritual that occurs in a very similar fashion to provide security and depth of meaning. Others want the sort of external sensory experience of a lofty cathedral and stained glass to loft themselves into an experience that draws from them the greatest expressions of worship. Others want an emotional immediacy of the spirit and the kind of dynamism that comes from ecstasy that happens much more internally. And so we're all, in some respects, and I think we've done some work, Alden, in the temperaments to parallel different kinds of worship experiences with certain kinds of personality types. And the challenge is to make worship and worship experiences, I think, holistic enough or complete enough so that the elements are there for all, and all can somehow experience worship in ways that are meaningful. That's a challenge. But if you go one way or another way and you're excluding some, then that is problematic.
That's one reason why I would like to see church more in the sense of tribe. I'd like to recover kind of that Old Testament sense so you don't have to constantly be making choices as to whether or not you belong. And if the Bible were merely a human book, then you could fragment it all over the place. But I think it's really fascinating to see how the Spirit, in Psalm 51, brings both sides together in an amazing way. Now, if you look at the way the psalm was put together, and this is the great penitential psalm, the heading attributes it to reflection on David's sin with Bathsheba. And if there ever was a psalm that called to internal reflections, this is one. And you see it, for instance, beginning with verse 15, 16, and 17. O Lord, open my lips. My mouth will declare your praise, for you have no delight in sacrifice. If I were to give a burnt offering, you would not be pleased. Sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit, a broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise. And then, after if you absorb the thrust of that verse, then you come, do good to Zion in your good pleasure, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. Then you will delight in right sacrifices, in burnt offerings and whole burnt offerings. Then bulls will be offered on your altar. Under the guidance of the Spirit, you have a concrete ritual passage put side by side with one which just has to do with pure religion of the heart. Yeah. And I think that is just fascinating. But that's the tussle we face today, because people get very irritated at whatever happens in their local church if it doesn't meet their local needs. I'm out of here.
Yeah, and it is a challenge when you don't have options and maybe are worshiping, like you just said, in a setting where there isn't the both and, but it's just one or the other. Mm-hmm. I think that's challenging.
So one more aspect that I would like for us to address here, and it's one which is we will be coming at several times during this quarter as we discuss the meaning of the cross. But it has to go with Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 is really a tantalizing chapter because it's nowhere labeled in the chapter as being messianic. It is simply the suffering servant. And I don't know what reflections you have on this, but I have often pondered how it was that Jesus, in his study of the Old Testament, the Bible, came to focus on that passage as being the touchstone for his ministry. It's an amazing development.
I think that this was a passage that resonated with his experience and therefore had power and meaning for him. No one, in anticipating the mission or work of the Messiah from the Jewish community, could imagine the Messiah living or hurting in terms of his deep involvement with suffering humanity in the way that that Jesus recognized and experienced his work.
It's still a challenge today for many people to, I mean, it goes beyond a challenge. It's just they cannot conceive of the Son of God suffering and to the point of death as he did. That is just too much. God would not allow that to happen. So it's still a stumbling block in a certain sense for people today.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is an important key to the Old Testament kingship, which, of course, Jesus saw, is that the king was, it was his mandate to make sure that he cared for the vulnerable members of society. And you can't do that unless you have a certain amount of power. And that's where I think the king was supposed to have used his power. Help the widows, the orphans, the homeless. So there's an important tie with the Messiah. But the suffering servant simply goes so much further than that, that it was amazing for Jesus to understand that that was his fate. I think that is one that we will probably spend pondering throughout eternity. Now, we may have just a few moments left here. Some of the prophets really come down hard against ritual, any kind of ritual. Do you think that was driven by exasperation, or should we take them more seriously?
Well, yeah, I think there's a level of exasperation there. I mean, just in the words that they describe, I mean, there seems to be exasperation in their voices, if we could hear them even. Some very strong words in Amos and Isaiah, even in Jeremiah and so forth. I mean, so yeah, I think there's some exasperation there, certainly.
I think we get pretty exasperated with each other, though, when you take something very simple like the words, I love you. They can be spoken with absolutely void of any sort of content, mm-hmm. of conviction or intentionality, done as a kind of duty, or something that you let roll off your tongue as trivial. And when we experience that with someone, then in that sense, it's really, really difficult.
Well, we're going to have to carry this conversation on again next week because our time is running short. Thank you, Paul and Larry, for your participation. And thanks to Susan Michael, our program engineer, and to all of you for listening in. For Probe, I'm Alden Thompson.
You've been listening to Probe, a production of the School of Theology at Walla Walla College and KGTS-FM. To order a copy of today's broadcast, you can call 509-527-2194 or email us at probe@wwc.edu. Thanks for listening. We'll be here next week at this time with Probe.